Welcome to 10 Frames Per Second, a podcast about photojournalism with photojournalists for everyone. Hosted by J.M. Giordano and Elena Volkova.
Welcome back to 10 Frames Per Second. Our guest today, a very special guest, he is a third generation photojournalist from Baltimore. Webster Phillips. It's a 70-year legacy in his family of photography, and I am like super excited to have him on the podcast. So we're going to forego the news and things, and we're going to get right into it because I think it's going to be a really interesting discussion. First, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, now, thanks for having me here.
Before we get into the questions, you want to give us a history of you and your grandfather and father as photographers?
Sure. So my grandfather came back from the war and began working as a photographer for the Afro newspaper. His brother was a photographer there, and Frank Phillips, and he began to learn photography. He worked there for maybe 40 years, covered the civil rights movement.
In Baltimore?
In Baltimore. Mm-hmm. At that time, the Afro was a national paper. Daily. So he did travel a lot with the paper, but was based out of Baltimore. So covered everything from sports to, you know, neighborhood life, civil rights, a little bit of everything. My father shot for the Afro for a little while, then went to Vietnam. And when he came back from Vietnam, he was offered a position at the Sun Papers. He was the first African-American photographer there. He covered the Orioles, the Colts, the Bullets from 70 to 80, as well as covering general news assignments, anything else, everything from weather to whatever you see. I learned photography from him starting out, just kind of going out on assignments with him on Saturdays, going to, you know, the jobs that he had lined up for the day. And shortly after that, it just kind of turned into a business for me. People started calling me up, asking me to do events, different things. And then I just started kind of chronicling life in Baltimore as I see it.
So did you ever shoot for any of the papers or any of the, did you ever put in for it?
Yeah, I actually shot, I shot for a paper back in 99, the Baltimore Press. Mm-hmm. The daily, it was around for about a year. I realized after I was there for a little bit that it was kind of thought it was like part of the O'Malley political machine. They were heavy into politics. And then the paper, after about a year, after that mayor race of 99, where it was everybody in Baltimore was running for mayor, it was Carl Stokes. Mm-hmm. It was, must have been 14 people running for mayor. O'Malley ended up winning, and then the paper folded, and I shot for the Afro a few years back, freelance for them for a few years.
Do they still take freelance? Do you know?
The Afro, I think so. Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. That's cool. We'll kick it over to Elena. She's anxiously awaiting to ask you a question. So,
you must have had a really interesting childhood, having two photographers, two role models growing up with. Could you tell us a little bit about how you grew up and what you were doing as a kid?
It was always cameras around, and it's kind of like you're not really conscious of it till later about how much cameras are around. Like, my dad kind of put a camera in my hand early, you know, gave me a few settings of like, look, as long as you use these, the picture will come out. And he just stuck the camera in my hand, like really young, like maybe 4 or 5. It's like about the age where I could hold the camera and not drop it. And then just told me to shoot wherever we were. Anytime we were anywhere, he would just kind of, you know, give me the camera and say, just, you know, pick up what you see. But I mean, you begin to look at things a little bit differently when you're used to looking through the eye of the camera. So back then, my thing was I would just hold it up to my face kind of all the time and just walk around with it. So,
what was your first camera? I'm just going to break protocol. We never talk about gear as one of our rules, but I'm going to break
protocol.
What was
your gear like in 1983?
Yeah,
I guess it was the F3.
Mm-hmm, so like, you're
with a motor drive on it.
Okay, you can stay.
Yeah. Yeah. Flash on it, you know, everything 250 at 8.
Did you ever use your grandfather? Like, I mean, I'm sure he had like a Graflex or one of the big press cameras, right? Or was he also the smaller cameras?
What he would do then was he would carry the Graflex with him, and he would get his overall shot. And if he shot a group shot, he would shoot one with that. He would also carry the Hasselblad and shoot with that. And he would carry the 35 millimeter.
Yeah.
So he would always get a large format shot, and then he would shoot everything else depending on, I guess, how he feels with the 120.
Do you have all these cameras?
I do. Two of them are kind of hard to find right now. I got to do some digging in one of my...
Which ones?
I mean, the one of the Graflex and the Hasselblad. So I gotta dig those out of a garage somewhere, unfortunately.
I'll help you.
Yeah.
Did you always know that this is something that you're going to pick up from your grandfather?
Not really. I always loved photography, but... It around 14 or 15, it just became a way to pick up some extra cash. People would call you up, say, hey, can you come shoot this for me? Can you come shoot my game, my basketball game? Can you come shoot my party? And I realized that it was a way for me to make a living, and then really began to enjoy telling stories via the camera. So I just kind of stuck with it. And then when I started to kind of run into, we found a box of negatives when I was in high school, that my father didn't even know we had in our basement. And once I started looking through those, kind of realized the importance of the photos and the first stage of archiving. So a lot of times, you know, you're looking at the negative, unless you print it, you know, you can put it on a light board, but unless you print it, you really don't know what you're really looking at. And being so young, I wasn't familiar with a lot of people. Some of the images, you can look at them and you can say, oh, you know, this is, you know, Louis Armstrong, or this person is Jackie Robinson, but the majority of the people, you don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the technology really wasn't there to scan them and figure out who everyone is. So
you had to physically print everything.
If you wanted to really know what it was, you had to print it, you know.
Is that how you stumbled upon Billie Holiday's photo with the brown bag?
Yeah, my father recognized that one, and it just looks like a lady walking down the street until you print it. You don't really know it's, you know, like Louis Armstrong, he's holding the horn in the picture. You know it's Louis Armstrong. Jackie Robinson has the Dodgers uniform on. Mm-hmm. You know it's Jackie Robinson. But the Billy one was one that you print, and you're like, wow, that's Billie Holiday. Yeah.
That must be incredible.
Yeah.
And where was that photo taken?
The Billie Holiday? Pennsylvania Avenue.
Is that the Sphinx Club?
No, she's actually just walking up the street, and I feel like it was one of those things where he just kind of caught her coming out the store.
Mm-hmm. She has the store.
Yeah.
I call Beyonce coming to Dollar General. You see that? Like,
with a brown bag in her hand.
Brown bag and an
umbrella.
And a fur.
Yeah. You know.
So as a kid, how did you synthesize these images? Did they mean something to you? What did you learn as you watched your father and grandfather work?
At a young age, I mean, you kind of see, you see how they kind of approach a job, and you see how they... kind of record it to convey kind of the scene of it. And most of the time, they're just really trying to catch what's going on at the time and give you something interesting, but also something that kind of goes along with the story of why the person's in town or why they're here, why they're there. But in an instance like that Billie Holiday show, it's like if you have your camera and you see something, if you got it with you, that's what you can kind of catch something. So it's like just being prepared kind of does all the work for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I try to approach shooting every day. Kind of see how you realize that when you're telling a story with a photograph, people are going to see it however you project it. So you can kind of control the narrative of a situation. And, you know, that's why you see a lot of photos today where in like news, a lot of people are projecting what they want you to see through the image. And sometimes I try to look past the surface of the image to try to see what else is going on sometimes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to your style, did you develop your style based on looking at, you know, your grandfather's and father's work, or were you more inspired by like outside photographers, you know, like quote unquote classic photographers, air quotes, or the more classic photographers, or did you just strictly stick with the photos that you were exposed to?
It's weird because I just try to catch stuff as it is. I couldn't put necessarily, I wouldn't even really say I had a style of shooting. Portrait wise, there's always those certain things that they tell you, like the basics about just making sure the picture comes out, especially when you're like dealing with film. But just really trying to catch the person. A lot of times mood, you know what I mean? Trying to convey mood, trying to show a little bit of where you are to put things in context, you know, shooting a tight shot, shooting a wide shot to show people, like Nimadel would say, always get a wide shot of the room because people who aren't there, they want to see what's going on. You shoot someone tight, you know, the background might be blurred or you can see a little bit going on there. But really trying to just show, you know, true to life what's really going on at that moment, wherever you are. You know, if it's on the street, if it's at a job somewhere, just trying to really, really capture everything.
Do you feel like you're continuing the legacy of your father and grandfather capturing? Do you do street photography as well? Do you are you interested in that sort of?
I do
recording lives and record of.
I do. I carry my camera everywhere I go. So if I see something that grabs me, I'll shoot it. If I'm walking down the street and I see something interesting, I'll shoot it. A lot of times, just having the camera with you, people will say, "Oh, you're a photographer," and then anyone who asks me and says something about the camera, I'll usually shoot them.
So you have an interaction with the subjects, and you tell them what you're doing, and do you tell them a little bit of the history?
Not really, unless they ask. A lot of times I'll try to get an email or something, or if I know where someone works, you know, it might be 5 years from that day, but I try to bring a photo by and give it to them, or try to give them the print. I like to pretty much just let the situation do the work for me. Mm-hmm. You know, like if I ride by somewhere and I see something, I'll hop out. If I go somewhere and I'm hanging out and I see something interesting, I'll snap it. And that's pretty much how it comes together.
Do you find, Phil, because I see you out a lot. It's kind of the same events. Do you find, because of the kind of political forces now, we're living in this like bizarro 60s world, right, where all this stuff is kind of coming back where it shouldn't be coming back? Yeah. I mean, we're still fighting for civil rights when, you know, we thought that should have been stuff been done. Yeah. But do you see your work being a little more political than, say, your father's or grandfather's? I mean, like so the show that I saw at UB Blake, that was you and your dad. Was your grandfather was working that? So looking at all three, I'm assuming your dad might have been in Vietnam during 68. I mean, that seems to be a prime. That seems to be like that era. But I didn't see much of the you know, recording of the political stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself breaking out of that mold to record like things like the uprising or these protests or things like that?
I got some shots during the uprising. It's funny because that day I was shooting something else and a friend of mine called me and was like, "Man, the helicopters are out everywhere downtown. They're blocking off traffic on Light and Pratt." And so I was like, I was parked over by where the farmer's market, where Sonar used to be. And I walked down and then you start to see the cops on the horses. You start to see the guys with the riot gear, like already kind of rolling up. And I guess at that point, everything was going on down probably where you were at, over by the stadium. I didn't really quite make it that far. I got to Pratt and Light. It was kind of shooting there, and I didn't really realize what was going on right down the street until a little bit later. So I shot some of that. I'm located on the east side now, so I kind of watched stuff go down from the roof of my building. And then kind of shot stuff here and there. My dad was right in the middle of the civil rights movement. A lot of those photos I haven't yet started to really archive and dive into. I'm still working my way up through the 4x5 negatives, my grandfather stuff, and I also haven't even dove into a lot of the civil rights stuff that he shot.
Isn't it interesting? Sometimes it's just the job of the curators, right? Is that it's the agenda they want to, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, history belongs to the curators, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, that particular show I curated.
At UB.
Yeah, at UB Blake. But right now it's just I wanted to have like a slice of the uprising in there and a slice of civil rights. For instance, there's a shot of a kid on a bike looking through a gate. Mm-hmm. And if you look closely, he's looking into the, which was the white pool, the main pool, the big pool now at Druid Hill. And if you look inside of the people, they're all white. He's just kind of looking in. Shots like that, rather than like a protest shot or, you know, a shot at an uprising. I mean, also now, just photography, we're living in a different time. You know, like back then at a protest or a march, it might have been 20 photographers. I went on a walk. It was a West Wednesday I went to, mm-hmm. and they did kind of a walk somewhere. And it was probably more photographers at one point than it were just people just kind of walking on the march. So a lot of people are telling those stories now. And I wanted to kind of show a different side of Baltimore, like a different slice of life, like kind of show up the feeling of the time without necessarily going straight for the mm-hmm. for the protest kind of shots or the march kind of right. thing.
And just for clarity, Phil mentioned West Wednesdays. That is an event every Wednesday for the past 4 years now, I think.
Since I feel like it's something like 200 and something weeks consistently
straight through
every week, never missed a week.
Right. Or the sister of Tyrone West, who was killed while in police custody in 2013. They have a group of protesters every Wednesday at mm-hmm. various locations in the city, Greenmount, the Northeast District, mm-hmm. In honor of his name, and they march, and they've been doing it so for our listeners that don't know what West Wednesday is, just wanted to clear that up.
Yeah. Interesting. So, Phil, what did it mean for a black person to be a photographer in your grandfather's times? And what does it mean to you now?
Kind of think the same thing. Of course, I feel like based on just what's available to people, that styles have definitely branched out and people are doing a lot of different kinds of photography. But it's still at the end of the day, you're telling a story. You're letting people see, you know, life through your eyes. Back then, you know, he would shoot everything from family portraits. So kind of when I'm looking back through the archive, you're seeing kids playing outside. You know, if he was on his way home from work and he saw one of his buddies somewhere, he would hop out, snap a portrait of him, you know, print him out the photo the next day, you know, when he's back in the lab, or go down in the basement when he gets home and print it out.
What about in white spaces?
In white spaces, you're not there that much. I mean, back then, especially like there are times where I'll run into a photo and I'm like, man, how was he here? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Like which ones? Can you give us an example?
I was showing someone some pictures yesterday, working on trying to put together an installation somewhere. And I ran across a photo where it's like maybe 8 or 9 white women half naked. In kind of a courtyard garden situation, and he's shooting it kind of from a bird's eye view. And the one woman has a long white scarf that it looks like she's like swinging to put around her, like a sheer robe, and it's kind of in air, like caught in mid-shot. The other women are kind of standing semicircle, all really dressed like nice lingerie, but a lot of them topless. And I'm like, where are you? And it's like, how do you get into a space where, like, who called you up and said, hey, Irv, we need you to, you know, Henry, we need you to shoot this, get this shot. And someone knew him, but that's one of the examples of one of the only photos where you'll see all white people, or it was something where, you know, someone was maybe integrating something, or business meetings you usually see. You'll see, like, maybe a black businessman who's doing business with a group of white men, but you don't really see many shots of like the same neighborhood shots that he would have in West and East Baltimore. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't see him going into South Baltimore and getting those street scenes mm-hmm. and kind of stuff in those kind of spaces.
That would have been pretty dangerous back then.
Yeah, definitely back then, depending on where you are and also depending on who you're with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that day, I'm sure he wasn't sneaking on set, you know, kind of jumping over a wall to take that picture of those women that I mentioned. Someone called you up and invited you kind of into that space.
What about for you?
Yeah, I was going to ask.
For me these days, I end up in a lot of different random spaces. So I went to Went to school in the city, then went to school in the county. So I went from being in an all-black school to being pretty much the only black kid in the class. So you're in those spaces. Doing event photography, a lot of times you get hired, you do a wedding. You know, I've been at weddings, shooting weddings where I'm the only black guy there. It's 150 people. And, you know, it's just, you just cover the event pretty much. Covering news-wise, most of the time now, I don't really run into those situations. And even when I was shooting where it was anything political, like if I was going into a space and it was all white, I didn't run into that too much. Maybe I shot a story when they installed the first camera in Baltimore City before it was blue light district kind of thing, like right at beginning of like zero tolerance. They had some cameras downtown like in like late 90s when I was in high school, like 97.
Right.
You started to see cameras in alleys real discreetly placed. And then I shot a picture of the first camera.
Where was it?
It was in Greektown. It's a church there, kind of Eastern Avenue, kind of a little bit past the bridge, a little bit past where Zorba's and all those kind of spots are.
Yeah, St. Nicholas Church.
I think so. Mm-hmm. And it was the first camera that, and actually at that time, it was monitored by people in the neighborhood. And it was one of those 360 cameras that could zoom, and you went to the police station, you kind of saw the hookup. And it was only monitored maybe 4 or 8 hours a day by police, and the other hours a day was monitored by volunteers. And that was the first one in the city. And that was like kind of being in that space in Greektown, going into the church, taking photos in the church, taking photos of the camera that was mounted near there, and then going to the police station and kind of shooting that. But usually it's pretty mellow if I'm in a space. It's because someone hired me to be there, you know.
And what about white photographers in black spaces? What do you, when we had Shan Wallace on the show, that was one of the main things that we discussed about white photojournalists coming into black communities. Do you have any thoughts on that or anything that?
I mean, in the climate now, a lot of it is just like intent and also, you know, just like whether or not you're respectful of the community. Because a lot of times in the climate that we're in now, it can be touchy. But most of the time, I feel like white photographers are usually embraced when they come into black communities, and people kind of give them the benefit of the doubt until they have a reason not to. But, you know, just like anything else, you know, if it's a situation where, you know, like when you take a photograph, that person is going to see, to someone who's never been to Sandtown, the viewer is going to see that photo through the eyes that you show them. So if you go there and you only shoot abandoned buildings, you want it to look like a war zone, and that's what you're portraying, then, you know, kind of what are you really there for? But if you're going to go in, you're going to talk to people, you're going to kind of get a narrative to go along with the photos, then that's also a different story. So I think it's just basically about intent, you know?
Because we discussed being invited, like you're a guest there. We tried to stress too, when we talked to Shan about, you know, the white privilege of being to be able to go wherever you want doesn't really play. You're a guest in those communities, and you have to understand that. So, I mean, how does the imagery affect the community psyche? Like, if how people responded to the photos you've taken to them and from outside, like, how does that? Yeah, how does that affect the community?
I think it's just like kind of shooting stuff honestly. And, you know, like if I pop up and I ride down the street and I see someone I know and I hop out and take a shot, or I see something interesting, I hop out and I say, hey, you know, can I snap a picture? Usually it's something that makes me feel good about that shot that makes me want to capture it and say, you know, like I saw, you probably know Alco. I was riding down Biddle and I saw him like on his stoop, like playing chess with himself.
That's cool.
And I was like, let me stop and snap a picture of this, you know, and he's sitting on the abandoned house right next door to where he lives. And he's kind of just playing himself on a Sunday morning. And that was a shot where I was just like, this is a shot that makes me feel good. Like I remember doing that, sitting on my steps, playing chess with myself, waiting for someone to walk up and get a game. So something like that, where it's like, you know, I'm going to go back and eventually, you know, he'll get a print of that or he'll get a shot. But That kind of thing. Just trying to really look at things through honest eyes and not necessarily like, you know, I'm trying to compare, you know, West Baltimore to, mm-hmm. you know, Syria or something like that and get a shot somewhere, but don't really care about what's going on there and
right.
not trying to, you know, like show the authenticity of really what's going on, you know, because it's easy to ride through Baltimore and take pictures of abandoned buildings, but there are so many neighborhoods right around the corner from where you might see a block of, you know, abandoned row homes mm-hmm. where the lawns are manicured, where it's, you know, right. people just living their life, kids playing, green grass, you know, like I feel like still there's a lot of blighted homes in Baltimore, but a lot of times people don't show the good side. Like a lot of times when there are shows, even when I see older stuff, it's always white colored. It's always, you know, protests or, mm-hmm. or stuff that's really like, you know, pulls at a lot of people's heartstrings, but there's not a lot of family portraits or kids playing mm-hmm. or.
Do you ever make it up to like the more affluent, like African American neighbor, like up by Morgan where the mm-hmm. single homes and things? Cause I mean, nobody sees that side.
Yeah.
You know, one of our city paper photographers lives up there and it's just great. And it's I'd say majority black families, but mm-hmm. single homes. Yeah. You ever make it up that way?
Yeah, I shoot. I mean, up there, it's kind of one of those things where I drive through, mm-hmm. and if I see something, I'll snap it. Even over by where I'm located now, over by Bel Air and Erdman, you ride through a lot of those side streets, and it's just,
yeah.
you know, it's Baltimore. Frankfurt, you know, it's no trash out. You know what I mean? Everyone's, you know, you get it, go over it on the weekend, people are cutting their grass, washing their mm-hmm. cars, kids outside playing. Somebody might be grilling on the front. But that's not always sexy to show if you're a photographer coming in from the outside, like photographers like Shannon, Devin, you know, like Reginald is doing the basketball thing with the pickup ball kind of thing. He mm-hmm. went from doing the poly thing to that. They're showing that other side, which is needed. You know, it's like it's not all post uprising kind of like abandoned house thing was, which right. you see a lot, but it's good to show that balance.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, you covered all my questions. I'm like, I'm going to ask this, but this is great. It's definitely very important to see the positive images of people just living their lives peacefully, as Joe mentioned. I'm sure the portrayal of black communities in the media definitely affects the psyche and their daily lives and how, you know, just this is like a never-ending cycle, you know, showing that the poor neighborhoods are still poor and no change is happening. And I feel like that the work that your grandfather and father did and seems like you continue to do is very important, specifically for the community.
Sorry, just got lost a little bit.
What about your upcoming projects? It says on your Facebook page.
Yes, talk a little bit about the project of archiving your grandfather's work. And I really enjoyed your posts and asking the community to recognize people in the photographs. Have you had much success with that? And tell us
how. We have. So lately, a few years back, I was teaching photography at Baltimore Talent Development High School, which was like the old Holland Park. And a good friend of mine, Gerald Baker, was a history teacher there. And he gave the class an assignment to interview the elder and their family and get stories about Baltimore and kind of come back and share the stories with the class. And then he tried to go, and he was kind of in search of visuals to kind of back this stuff up. So he went to a lot of different resources, and he really wasn't able to find the visuals to make it click with the kids. And at that point, I'd maybe scanned 200-300 negatives. And he got a hold of those, and when we saw the kids' reaction to those, it made them want to learn more about the neighborhood. They didn't realize that a lot of the neighborhoods they live in didn't always look like that in some areas. So it kind of sparked them to do a short documentary that was called We Used to Drive Our Steps. And that was when I really realized the importance of, you know, you always know it kind of in the back of your mind. These pictures are historical, you know, it's history. But that was when it really clicked. And I saw how much these kids needed to be able to have a resource where they could see their history. and not only kind of see what it used to look like, but see how the community worked socially, kind of see how it worked with recreation, kind of see how the business works, where the dollar wasn't, you know, leaving the community, you know, 10 minutes mm-hmm. after people cashed their checks on Friday, you know, the money was circulating. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of when I stopped everything I was doing and just began to scan negatives, you know, pretty much as a full-time job, 8 hours a day, until I put a dent in it. When I got to scanning about 10,000 negatives, I stopped to try to organize and identify everything, mm-hmm. be able to pull everything out by keyword, but also have some kind of historical content behind the photos. And only about a quarter of these photos were either recognizable by me, or I was able to get my father or one of my aunts to kind of identify. So I started putting a photo online here and there, and asking people to circulate them and say, hey, you know, take your smartphone, show it to your grandmother, show it to one of your aunts or your uncles, see if they recognize someone. And about one out of every four or five pictures will get someone to say, hey, you know, I know this person. So hopefully that'll kind of turn into something where getting more things identified. If I can get a group, recently I was going to the library over on Lean Street. I think it's the Dunbar class of like 1938 or something, 1940, something like that. And I've been going over there, and I went over there recently and just projected about maybe 100 images up on the screen and see if anyone recognized anything. If someone says, hey, I was a teacher, I pull up the education, type in school and keywords and flip through and see if they recognize anyone. If someone says, hey, I used to work at a car dealership, I'll type in cars, and usually you'll get a hit on something.
Have you seen that, you know, that new Dunbar book that's been published?
The one on
I think it's on the history of the basketball team. But that author did a lot of, I mean, if you were looking for someone to mm-hmm. identify the people in those photos, mm-hmm. I mean, he'd probably be one of the, he's local.
I think they did a 30 for 30, or they're supposed to be doing 30 for 30 on that team, the Muncie Bogues team.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which I'm looking forward to that, but that's going to be good.
Phil, growing up in Baltimore, having grown up in Baltimore, what is Baltimore like as a landscape for photography?
That's a good one. I mean, a lot of times you couldn't get a better landscape. I mean, and to say better, it's like you'll always get different landscapes, but there's only one Baltimore. It's like if I was shooting in Cali. In Oakland, they have their history. Baltimore's kind of just got thrown onto the map, like, you know, for all the wrong reasons, mm-hmm. you know, like a lot of different places around the country. And it's kind of like you're at one of those points now where you're like, let's see where this goes. Like, looking back through the history of photos, you see black flight, you see white flight, you see kind of how, you know, how real estate developers kind of figured out, you know, how to sell these brand new houses in the county to people that they tricked from moving out of the city. And you see these patterns of how things happen. And then now you kind of wonder, okay, what's next? What's Baltimore 10, 15, 20 years from now, from this point? Like, now that we're in the spotlight, you know, like, people talk about change, and a lot of times you don't see the change that's going on. There's a ton of change going on. It's just not being shown. And that's a big reason of why, like, the archiving and why these photographers that are around in Baltimore now are so important, because it's about really who's telling the story. Mm. And a lot of people have approached us trying to, like, buy the collection and different things like that back in the day when we were in the early stages. And my dad really was really adamant about holding on to it, because the pictures end up in the basement of a museum. We're not telling the story. They do a show every 20 years and sell some photos and, you know, license some photos, but there's no history behind it. Mm. Like, eventually these photographs will be online and kids will be able to go in there and actually look at these photos and have the correct history behind them, and also be able to learn from them, not just a scene with a picture and a caption, but really how this picture reflects on the community then and how it kind of translates to now.
Are there any organizations you talk to about legacy, about like UB Blake or the Historical Society, about taking the whole collection?
Not locally. It was more like, you know, those big stock archives like Getty, Corpus, like back in the day, mm-hmm. That, you know, people say to you, man, you know, why don't you try to, you know, why don't you just sell all this stuff to Getty? Why don't you just sell all this stuff to, and I mean, this is also way back in the day. This is like beginning of the internet kind of thing, beginning of, you know, like dial up internet days kind of thing. And people trying to broker deals. I had someone who tried to sit down with you at a table and hand you a paper that basically says that you're going to sign your whole collection off to them. And it's like, who do you, you know, it's amazing what people would try to do. And a lot of times, you know, if I wasn't a photographer, the collection might've ended up, you know, in someone else's hands because, you know, or if my father wasn't a photographer, because people have these gems and these treasures in their basements and they're not really doing anything with them. So they say, you know, donating it to a historical society or to a museum, you know, it's not the worst thing you can do with the photos, but a lot of times you'll lose the history kind of that way, especially when it's a history that's right now not really available like that, you know.
Unfortunately, historical societies don't have the resources to process all those. Yeah. I was just talking to somebody from the Joe Trapea from Maryland, and he's they simply don't have enough staff.
Yeah, it's only so much you can do.
UMBC's pretty good, though. Yeah. UMBC's got a really tight photo department. I did have a question. It came to me this morning when I was looking over the photos, like Billie Holiday and Louis Armstrong. When did the African American celebrities seem to be? And this is with, I mean, Gordon Parks, Roy D. Carava, the jazz photographer, William Claxton. It seems to be, I guess, because of segregation, the black celebrities were more accessible to the community. Than they are now. Like, you would never see, you know, like someone like Beyonce come out of like Dollar General with her bag. Yeah. When do you think that changed? And do you think that had an effect on celebrity photography?
I feel like that might have changed when, you know, as media grows and as your fan base grows. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, like with integration and being able to perform at bigger venues, you know, the purses get bigger. Times change, but even now, when you look around, a lot of celebrities are more accessible than you think. It's just a matter of who's in those spaces. Like, I was looking through Shan's timeline, and she's shooting a film festival, and everyone's right there with you. Yeah. Like, it's somewhat of a controlled environment. You know, it's not out on the street. Mm-hmm. But then if you were to look through other people's timelines, you'll see people like, oh man, I ran into this person at this store. I took a selfie with them. You know what I mean? So it's a little different. But I mean, back then, Baltimore was part of that circuit where if people came in town, there was only one or two photographers, you know, at the theater that time probably taking photos. And if Nat King Cole wanted a photo, he might have had a point and shoot or something that he could take pictures of other people. I know a lot of cats back then did kind of turn into photographers just because they knew they were around those situations. They would get a camera and shoot. But back then, there might only be two or three professionals or two or three cameras in a space at a time that was really going to give you a nice professional shot. Mm-hmm. So they looked to you to be in the mix. And also as far as like with segregation, like when Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier and my grandfather and Sam Lacey were traveling with him down south and traveling all around, they're staying together. They're eating at the same restaurant. They're staying at the same hotel, just by design, you know, back then. It's a little different, you know, a little different than now. But I still feel like now, a lot of times, depending on the situation, you know, if you're backstage and there's celebrities, most of them are pretty open, you know. And I'm sure there was even a celebrity back then that was like, nah, no cameras. Get that camera out of my face. You know what I mean? Kind of thing.
In your opinion, Phil, what does make a photograph timeless?
Timeless? I guess the feeling. You know, like the feeling you get when you look at the photograph and the content. You know, like, will it tell a story no matter what time and place you look at it to whoever looks at it? You know, it's like my dad always had a thing. He said, when you take a photograph, you're capturing that moment in history forever. If I shoot us right now, this will never happen again. You know, every photo you take, you're stopping that moment. It'll never happen again.
Mm-hmm. So we'll be wrapping up in a little bit, Phil. So which photographers or which books, you know, do you recommend that maybe some young shooters or people getting into it should take a look at?
There's one book, and this is The History of Man.
Mm-hmm.
That was a book that someone just kind of passed on to me that I enjoyed. I think it's The I Dream of World. Mm-hmm. Another.
This is Gordon Parks.
I think that's it was produced by Deborah Willis.
Okay.
I could have the name wrong on that one, but Deborah Willis puts together some great books, featuring a lot of different talented photographers that tell different stories. Mm-hmm.
Was that the Family of Man? You were,
yeah, I think that might have been.
Yeah, the family. Yeah, that's the Steichen exhibition that shows a pretty.
I got issues
with Family of Man.
Yeah. I mean, but as far as the photographs go, it's an interesting take. And also, it's just like, you know, for, you know, the person that's never been to the hood who's looking at Beautiful Ghetto by Devin Allen, it's like, you know, you're peeping into other people's worlds. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, of course, some worlds are shown more than others, but, you know, that kind of just goes with the territory.
You ever look at, like, Roy D. Caraba's work?
Yeah.
What's your opinion of his stuff?
I enjoy it. He's definitely somebody that was like pushing the styles.
He's so underrated, man.
Of back then. And he's also somebody that I learned about kind of later on, like, you know, more recently in the last couple of years. And that's another reason why I feel like getting this archive out is so important. It's like people like, you know, like you hear about Gordon Parks, you hear about, you know, Van Der Zee, but you don't really hear about De Caraba, you don't hear about Henry Phillips Sr. You don't hear about a lot of people that are, chronicle, you know, like preserving, you know, life for decades, and you just don't hear about them. And it's history, you know, like people, you know, it's, if you don't see it, it's the tree falls in the forest. And if you don't see it, it doesn't exist.
Right.
So, like, you know, people like De Caraba, people like my grandfather,
right,
the work deserves to be seen, you know, and studied and spoke about, you know.
Cool. So
what would you, just considering that we have a lot of our listeners are students, what would you say to students? What is a photographer's role in the community?
Try to photograph something you're passionate about. You know, try to photograph something that's really going to tell a story and really going to show somebody something that they've maybe never seen before. Even if that's, you know, life on a small cul-de-sac somewhere, or it's, you know, your uncle fishing or something, you know, tell the deeper story behind what's on the surface a lot of the times. And it's gotta be something that you're passionate about. It can't just be something that, you know, which also, you know, works for some people is, you know, you're doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. But ideally, just something that's going to really hold your interest and something that you care about.
Mm-hmm. And I guess our final question, because I know you're going to start to run over. Phil, before you wrap it up, can you talk a little bit about the community of Pennsylvania Avenue and how it's changed? And, I mean, that seemed to be, at least for the West Side, that seemed to be kind of the hub of Black culture for over 100-some years. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about how the changes you've seen in the photographs of your family over the past like 60 years, and what was the role of the photographers in that community?
Kind of seems the same. I mean, that was a hub for business. It was a hub for music. It still is. I mean, if you ride down Pennsylvania Avenue right now, it's one of the only streets in Baltimore where it's, you know, it's like a Green Mountain 33rd, you know what I mean? It's people up and down, it's businesses. I was talking to someone the other day. I used to patronize a business on Pennsylvania Avenue, and for a couple of years ago, for a while, you couldn't park on the street. Like, the police had blocked off, you cannot park on certain areas. And I think it was partly because they were trying to stop what they say, like, the hand-to-hand kind of thing that was going on, and they wanted the police to be able to see, not be able to block behind the cars. But what the businessmen were telling me was that, you know, now my customers who drive here have to park 3 blocks away, they're not coming anymore. So it was almost like watching the reasons why these areas kind of went from then to now. You know, that was where you went to shop, and a lot of places, it was like a one-stop shop. You could get everything there. And as big box stores and big lot stores kind of popped up everywhere, you didn't have to go to the local guy to get your food. The situation kind of changed. But it's the same thing then as now. It's just like capturing a life, however it is, you know, like... A lot of times now, Pennsylvania Avenue is known for one thing. feel like Pennsylvania Avenue is also kind of coming back. I'm seeing stuff happening in Art Social. Of course, the Royal isn't there, and a lot of different places aren't there anymore. But people are doing stuff with local farmers markets at the Avenue Market. They're doing the big blue bag thing there. So it's a lot of positive stuff still going on. It's just all about what people choose to capture and choose to speak on in spaces like that.
Cool. Are you very much involved in that community?
Now, I grew up a couple blocks away, you know, a hop skip from there. I'm not over there too much. I'm on the east side now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm over there occasionally. We have an installation up at Jubilee Arts in conjunction with some students at Morgan. We did a few years back. So that's right there on Pennsylvania Avenue. People like Malaika are doing a ton mm-hmm. of stuff at Jubilee. They're doing movies on the wall there. They're mm-hmm. doing a whole bunch of programming, a whole bunch of resources for kids.
Upton, right?
Yeah, Upton right Square. Right Upton in the heart Park. Of right in the heart of Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Real quick, what is the biggest difference between the east side and west side in Baltimore?
It's a tough man. I think that people, it's one of those like Baltimore versus DC things. We have more really in common
mm-hmm.
than we do. Then there are differences. You know what I mean? Like neighborhoods like Bel Air and Edison remind me a lot of over by Warwick, like where my grandmother grew up. Mm-hmm. Like you go over there, the architecture is the same. The makeup of the neighborhood are kind of the same. It's just one of those like, I feel like Baltimore's, it's just like anyone else, is one of those like, oh, east side versus west side. It's like one of those things where it's like,
but
oh,
I mean, Baltimore. I mean, visually.
We're not LA.
Visually. No. I mean, because I grew up on the east side and I do a lot of work over in the west side with Boom and those guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I see a difference in shooting the communities in, but like, for instance, on the east side, they have so many gardens over there, right? Like there's little, you don't get that on the west side. That's what I mean. What, you know, as a photographer, what do you see as the difference in the environments on east side and west side?
I don't know, man. I really don't see much. I mean, there's slight differences. But for the most part, I feel like you got your neighborhoods with your two-story row houses, you got your neighborhoods with your three stories, you got your neighborhoods with the kind of double stacked mm-hmm. kind of houses with a space in between each two. Like, you know, you got your grass on both sides. You know, you have green spaces mm-hmm. like up over White Lot, a bunch of popping up. Park Heights has a different feel mm-hmm. a lot to me.
Definitely. Just
it has more of a like county feel, but in the city, it's like a really kind of mix over there.
Isn't there
but I
a lot more,
of similarities.
You know? A lot more gentrification on the east side than west side. Somehow east side is, because of the location, maybe proximity to the water, a lot more attention and money is you know, kind of being paid. A lot more attention is being
paid. I feel like
the
thoroughfares on there and kind of what they lead to with like Hopkins and like going up through Charles Street and the Charles mm-hmm. Theater, that area, and Station North and where Micah is. Everything seems to be spreading out from there. But, you know, like the first neighborhoods that were really gentrified in Baltimore are like Allentown, you know, Hamden mm-hmm. yeah. and like Canton.
The White Owl.
Exactly. Yeah. You know what I mean? Which is like a lot easier to, you know, if real estate guys, it's a lot easier to buy up those houses and move people right in because you don't, you know, it's a lot of people moving in, even if they're not conscious of it, you know, the people next door to you, even though they might be a different demographic, they still look mm-hmm. a lot more like you than if you were to go in and, you know, move in on the west side at the, you know, the end of North Avenue or something, you know.
Yeah. Well, cool. You want to take us home with the rapid-fire questions?
We have rapid-fire questions for you. These are three questions that require a quick answer. One, two words. Here we go. Photography is primarily a tool for?
Storytelling.
When I look at an image, I look for?
Intent.
A photographer is responsible for?
Photographer is responsible for truth.
All right.
Great.
That's cool.
Thank you.
Phil, any Instagram accounts you recommend? Anything you look at online real quick you want to put out there? Any photographers?
I say True Laurels.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence Bernie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, True Laurels. That's it, man. I mean, like, you know, all the local cats that are
we'll
like
put that on the
Reginald
website.
Thomas.
Yeah.
You know, all the local guys.
Oh, man.
Great. Thank you so much, Phil.
Yeah, hey, thanks for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it. This is a great discussion. Have a good one.
Look at us.
This has been 10 Frames Per Second, recorded at WLOI Radio at Loyola University, Maryland. Produced by Audrey Gatewood and John DeBeck.